This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. Masuaku, who'd have thought it? Chelsea blink in the title race as they lose in a topsy-turvy game at the London Stadium. Meanwhile, Divock Origi does one of his Divock Origi things for Liverpool, and Manchester City tear Watford apart. How tiring must it be to chase Bernardo, Foden, Grealish and Sterling around a football pitch? The Rangnick revolution begins at Manchester United, and how? Brackets, a scratchy 1-0 win over Crystal Palace. Close brackets. Three wins on the bounce for Spurs, but are they any good? Patrick Bamford's back, Kasper Schmeichel's got one hand on the ball, and Newcastle have won a football match. Also today, Chelsea eased past Arsenal in last year's Women's FA Cup final. There's toe-sucking fun in the FA Cup, more extraordinary listening commitment from you lot, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Troy Townsend, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back, Max.
Matt Mayo, looking forward to the fact that we can't look back at an Everton defeat because they haven't played yet this weekend.
Yeah, the less said about that. I've seen some of the criticism on social, so yeah. If you don't touch it, that would be great.
Barney Ronnie, welcome.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, you sound up for this one, Barney.
That's a good start, wasn't it? I won't be able to keep that up.
And the frenetic pace will only increase as I introduce Barry Glendenning. Welcome, Barry.
Hi, Max. I'm looking forward to getting Troy's thoughts on his son's brutal assault on... Who was it last week? His head, he tried to kick off his shoulders.
That's true. Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah. Oh, I can't remember. I can't remember that, Barry.
I'm sure the subject of the assault remembers it.
Some political satire to begin from Mark Coates, who says, are you allowed to analyse games retrospectively? Well, hopefully, because otherwise there's very little point in any of this. Let's begin at the London Stadium, West Ham 3, Chelsea 2. Barney, you were there. What a game. How was it?
Yeah, it was a really good game. I really didn't expect what happened to happen. I was talking to Miguel Delaney for the first 10 minutes, and we're talking about what... I couldn't really remember how Chelsea score goals. Like, I was trying to picture what sort of goals to Chelsea... It's a sort of interesting question, because they don't score breakaways because they always have the ball. And they don't seem to be playing centre-forward, so there's not really crosses. Basically, the goal is always the same thing. It's either a header from a set piece or a diagonal pass to a fullback who scores into the far corner. And they scored two, or sort of inside forward, they scored two goals exactly like that. And they seem to be, you know, it's just this, the Chelsea kind of machine keeps on right. I've got to stop calling them a machine, they're not a machine. But West Ham were really good, and there were kind of little errors, and Chelsea have blown a kind of 5-point lead at the top of the table, and you can see, you get the feeling that this team is it's this thing that Tuchel invented on the hoof last season really quickly, and then you can see sort of we'll get Lukaku and we'll slightly re-gear it. But it's still that same thing. It's like when you have a temporary little fix in your house, and 10 years later, you're still pulling a rubber band to turn on the light switch in the bathroom because it worked really well for ages, and is still spinning those plates. But they were sort of lacking, and I was sitting right behind Masuaka's goal, so you could see the arc of the ball. And it, just for one second, I thought, that's the greatest goal I've ever seen. And then he didn't really celebrate and looked embarrassed, and you realised it was a cross.
Jonathan Pearce on Match of the Day thought he meant it. And then he said, on such stories, dreams are made, which I thought was potentially slightly over the top. But Masuaku, yes, said, I was surprised as you were. And Barney, how was the atmosphere? Because it's almost as if you win games and your team is good, then you can turn around the poisonous, impossible to play football at this pace.
Yeah, well, I've changed my mind about that stadium. Now that everyone's happy in it, I really like it. I mean, it's still awful. It's still this weird netherworld where you can see it, but it doesn't get any closer, and you just keep walking. And it's this sort of strange... It's like a distant mountain on the desert skyline. And eventually you get there, but it's quite good. It's like... It's like being in a future city, you know, it's got that feeling of everything's weirdly bleak, but kind of new and quite interesting. And, you know, when they win, suddenly the the atmosphere is pretty good. It's still inside and downstairs. It's still like the Mos Eisley canteen. There are these, or kind of something out of the first Star Wars. You wander through these weird hangars, and there are these big empty rooms and odd groups of people walking past, like 50 stewards. And you're supposed to walk around a corner, and there'll be a weird bleeping machine or stormtroopers. And you never know what room you're going to. There are millions of different rooms and areas and spaces. But that's kind of quite exciting. And yeah, no, it was good. And it was noisy and the atmosphere was good. And Declan Rice was magnificent as well. What a player he is.
Jared Bowen as well, Troy, he was excellent. I could see him in a sort of Liverpool front three. And then I saw there are rumours linking him to Liverpool. I don't know if that's going too far. But he's a really good footballer, isn't he?
Yeah, those rumours have been around for quite a while, by the way, Max. So yeah,
they've only just reached here. They came on a boat, Troy, and they've just arrived.
He was very difficult to mark. That's probably as simple as you can say it. He looked like he was enjoying his football, got into really good spaces and pockets and deservedly got his goal. It's an interesting one because he doesn't get the limelight, I suppose, in the way that the others around him do. But definitely one who... Am I wrong in saying this, that looks like he could play for a club higher in the league, although West Ham are very high in the league, but looks like he could perform in a Liverpool front three and probably the most suitable team for him. But yeah, he's done really, really well. And I think he caused Chelsea havoc on Saturday.
I suppose that's an interesting thing about West Ham, Barry, isn't it? That almost none of them get the limelight. I guess Declan Rice does a bit and Mikel Antonio, but sort of as a group of players, you don't look at the team sheet and go, wow, I can't wait for this, or think that many of them are going to go on to sort of hugely bigger and better things. But they're doing incredibly well.
I would disagree. I think Declan Rice and Mikel Antonio get an awful lot of limelight particular team. But what David Moyes has done there is remarkable, I think. Just taken over a team which many expected to be in crisis at the start of last season because there was all sorts of boardroom bother and chaos, and he's brought in, I suppose, Thomas Souček probably and Vladimir Soufal probably sum up what you mean there. Two brilliant signings, very hard working, go about their business diligently. Souček chips in with the odd goal, and I don't think anyone expected much of them. So, yeah, they would be a good example of how West Ham are more than the sum of their parts.
Mm. And the question will be, Barney, which we will ask many times, is can they, you know, they seem to be the fourth best team in the division by quite a long way at the moment, but whether they can sustain that.
Yeah, Souček, Moyes wanted to sign Souček for ages. So he's a really good example of Moyes not just sort of inheriting a team. That was his idea, that player, and he really kind of made the case for him. So that he is a massive kind of thing for Moyes. But I think they can definitely hang in there. Rice is the best player in the Premier League in his position, in my opinion. And when you've got someone like that in such an important role, of course you can finish fourth. And they don't seem to be playing with any pressure as well. You know, they go 1-0 down to Chelsea. Well, we'll have a go and come back. And they were helped by some terrible goalkeeping from Mendy, who's been very good and saved the game against Brentford not so long ago. But yeah, I think they definitely finished fourth.
Can we talk about that Mason Mount volley, Barry, for a short amount of time? I thought it was really lovely.
I agree. It was really lovely.
Okay, let me try another question to get past the Barry barricades. I sort of felt Fabianski was slightly harshly accused of failing to be covering his near post when actually the goal was quite big and you can't expect a player really to do what Mason Mount did.
Yeah, he probably wasn't expecting the shot. I mean, I'm not never quite sure about criticising goalkeepers. He possibly could have been. I mean, Barney said there that Edouard Mendy had a bit of a mare, that West Ham were helped by some awful goalkeeping. But I thought, say, He was sold a bit of a pop.
Did you think the way he tricked his way around Bowen, escaped and played a nice pass upfield was good? I mean, he had one chance there to clear the ball. It was a slightly short back pass. Clear the ball. Don't try and... You're a massive guy against this little scurrying professional outfield footballer. You're not going to get past him. That was bad goalkeeping. Like, there can't be any doubt of that, Barry. But the interesting thing about the near post, do you remember... they once asked Kasper Schmeichel about that. You know, he got beaten at his near post there. And I remember him going off on a rant saying, this is so annoying to goalkeepers because the only thing anyone knows about goalies is, oh, we got beaten at his near post. And he's saying, like, we've got this massive goal. We're constantly making choices based on where's the angle? Where's this player go? I've studied the, you know, what he does. You don't just go, oh, well, you know, so long as it doesn't go in the near post, whatever you do is fine. And he says it absolutely drives them mad because obviously they know about the near post kind of thing. I thought that's
what
happened.
But you can't. The point is you can't get beaten at your near post.
You can't.
That's what everybody says. Right. I think Glenn Hoddle said it. You can't. You literally can't. But yet it happened. And, you know, we're all still here. Let's go to Watford, shall we? Watford 1, Manchester City 3. Pep said City have reached their highest standard so far this season. Jeff says, do Manchester City players have a raffle every 3 months for who's going to be unstoppable next? Clearly, Bernardo won the most recent draw following previous winners Gundogan and De Bruyne. I mean, they were so good. Well, it was sort of, I just sort of felt sorry, especially for Danny Rose, but for all the Watford defenders, really.
Yeah, we've been here before, haven't we, where Man City just click and it looks so easy on the eye. Watford were couldn't get near them to start with. You know, the movement of the ball again, the quality of the goals scored. I mean, the ease in which Raheem Sterling found himself. I had a little bit of sympathy, and maybe I'm the only one, for Danny Rose, because he did nearly find himself into the fans over the far side and got up and must have thought to himself, that hurt. So he didn't really want to get back in too quickly, did he, to go and, you know, even try and put Sterling off. And Foden's cross to Sterling was just on point. So, and once Man City started like that, I just thought there was no hope for Watford, to be totally honest. The control of the game, the ease in which they cut Watford open, Silva's, you know, first goal in Bernardo Silva's first goal in the first half, and then stunning second goal on the back. Are we allowed to mention last week's football on the back of an amazing goal against Villa the other day? They just look like they're purring at the moment, City. Really do. And it was good to see Watford get one because it almost kind of, you know, said, oh, this is a football match now. I don't know what minute it was. It was probably late 70th minute. But Hernandez, who has done really well in a Watford shirt, to be totally honest, pulled one back. But the result was never, it was never in doubt, was it? It was never in doubt from the opening goal. And that was inside the first 5 minutes. So, yeah.
I did suggest on the radio that Cucho Hernandez was the most optimistic, quickly grabbing the ball out of the net to take it back to the centre circle. Really, you'd be better off just having a rest there. Just say, listen, just have a little bit of time.
He did set up a second, though. He crossed for Josh King, who pulled the shot wide. So,
you do know you don't get nothing for almost, Barry, don't you?
Right, everyone's putting me back with my box today. First Barney, now Troy.
Just because I know what you've got coming for me later, that's all. So,
I mean, of these three, Barney, City, I mean, City were the best this weekend for sure, but have you decided who you think will win the Premier League?
Yeah, I think City will win it because they have, you know, such a strong squad. Liverpool are playing really well, but, you know, they're going to lose a couple of players and there might be some injuries. And I mean, City just this beautiful thing, aren't they? They're such a strange construct in that you think, wow, they're just this team of, like, it's like a perfect socialism. Everyone passes to everyone else. There are no stars in this team. And then you think, what am I talking about? Jack Grealish crossed 100 million. But it's kind of an illusion. The players are so good. But they play with this kind of selfless possession football. And you think, wow, even Bernardo Silva's getting a go. But Bernardo Silva is a brilliant player who's, you know, when I remember watching him in that Monaco team against Spurs and thinking, this guy is going to be a star at Barcelona or something. You know, it's just that he's in such a strong squad and they don't play in that kind of starry way. And, you know, it's all about possession. But it's amazing that football can create this kind of illusion where you think of Man City as this team of kind of, you know, a collective of Oompa Loompas who are selfless and embody some idea of teamwork. Whereas really they embody spending £1 billion on players and getting the best manager in the world and this kind of bolt-on Catalan model of, you know, how to train and how to play. But it looks brilliant and I love watching it.
I was going to say the most expensive Oompa Loompas, Barney, that have ever been put together, I think.
Yeah. Those Oompa Loompas, there are no stars there. They're all, well, it's the fact that they're all stars, so you don't notice who the star is. It's a very clever kind of, but you know, football's kind of a miracle like that. You just get lost in what you're seeing. And the fact is those players are very selfless. They do work really hard. They may have a huge price tag and huge salary, whatever, but they exemplify some sort of brilliant qualities, you know.
Jan says, how would you explain Divock Origi to someone who's new to football? He scored in injury time at Molineux. Klopp said, I love the boy. He's one of the best finishers I've seen in my life. And then he added, I hope he finds a manager that will give him more football someday, but I still love him. He's started 34 games in 7 seasons at Liverpool, which, Barry, is an odd existence, isn't it?
It is. It's like being a third or even second choice goalkeeper. You often see goalkeepers, you know, with appearances they might have been a goalkeeper for 15 years and they've only made, you know, 70 appearances. But if he is happy with that existence, then he's a great asset to have. I must confess, I had completely forgotten he was at Liverpool until he popped up with that goal. But the goals he scores are very important. And I'm not sure I'd be happy in that role because he could surely get more regular first-team football somewhere else. But if he's content, great.
Maybe he's just got a really perfect work-life balance. You know, he could write articles in the Observer magazine, couldn't he? About, you know, I don't really work very hard, but I just do quite well for myself and I'm really happy.
He does always look like he's having the time of his life and he seems like a really nice guy. I'd like to kind of, I wouldn't mind swapping places with him. It looks really fun. Whenever he has an interview, he's smiling and saying, yeah, that was good. I've played a game today. Did you see me out there? That was fun. He seems like a really nice bloke.
Troy, Diogo Jota's miss was absolutely tremendous, wasn't it?
Was it a miss? Do we class that as a miss? Connor Cody,
yes, because
on
I
the
think
line.
He should have scored a goal. I think he should have scored the goal, don't you think? I mean,
I don't want to
miss
start
the target.
This. Well, I don't
he
want
very
to start
much,
this on
He
target.
Very much hit the target, didn't he? He very much hit. I mean, I know you've been there before, but I think Connor Cody would argue he really did hit the target.
You know what? If I'm allowed to, on Friday night, I watched Steve Cook spread himself twice in a short space of time, which I thought was just amazing the way he kept the ball out. One was with his head, one was with his midriff. And Connor Cody did exactly the same. But it was more the fact that Jota, who's obviously on a great goal-scoring streak, didn't find the back of the net, as you say, Max. I think he just went for the ultimate power and just thought, yeah, I'm just going to smash this and whoever's going to get in the way is going to feel whatever the, you know, is on the end of this shot. And then you could say that, did he want to score? It's his former team, maybe knew that you know, Origi was going to come on a little bit later on and slot in the winner anyway. But no, I think
you think that Jota is so good, he can hit a ball with that power.
I'm just putting it out there, Max.
The undercarriage of Connor Cody with the goal gaping. It was amazing. I had to sit up straight.
I think it's one of those where I honestly think he just thought, listen, I'm just going to hit this with everything. It will fly in the back of the net. It will take whoever's in there trying to stop it, you know, put him in the back of the net. And it didn't happen. And no doubt he'll probably regret it because it's one less on his tally. But, you know, again, we have to applaud Connor Cody for getting back to where he did and for putting an element of his body in the way of that as well.
Thank you, Troy, for being so diplomatic. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Old Trafford. Well, welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, at some point, we're going to do one of those Christmas Q&A slightly drunken pods. I don't know at what time we're going to record this. It's going to be terrible for one of us, Barry. But footballweekly@theguardian.com if you have any questions that are timeless. And we'll do that over Christmas for your listening pleasure. Manchester United 1, Crystal Palace 0. Fred's 77th minute goal. What a brilliant goal it was as well. Ralf Rangnick, the first of the six Germans to manage in the Premier League to win his first game in the competition. After Felix Magath, Jurgen Klopp, Jan Sievert, remember him, Daniel Farke and Thomas Tuchel all previously failed to do so before. Cameron says, Ralf Rangnick plays exactly the same lineup, gets almost exactly the same result, a 1-0 goal, a one-goal win over a team from London. What's the least that panel members have ever done that was considered a radical change? Barney, did you see a radical change here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of predisposed to... I can't not like Ralf Rangnick. It's as though he could have been designed for me to kind of... He's a really funny guy. And, you know, he's a kind of Germanic, you know, bespectacled intellectual who uses ridiculous terms and has strange kind of personal weaknesses. And I just think he's really fascinating. It's kind of, I was looking at him talking actually at the Chelsea game thinking, wow, imagine if Wilson had like a German cousin who he'd introduced, this is my German cousin, Ralf. You kind of think, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, it's almost perfect for him. He shouldn't be allowed to write articles about him because there's something eerily, what's he going to say? Yeah, I don't like that guy. You know, he's Ralf Nick. What a fraud. But no, he's obviously really got them. I mean, he said afterwards, we can't sustain that level of pressing and intercepting and harrying the opposition. And obviously the players are going to put on a big show in their first game with this new manager. His entire life is based around how quickly will you close down the opposition. And he made a real point of praising multiple Ballon d'Or winner Cristiano Ronaldo and saying he did really well. He ran around quite a lot. That sort of like reminds me of when I used to manage an under-12s team. You'd sort of say he did really well, which is kind of odd. And I'm sure Cristiano was relieved to hear that Ralf is a fan. And obviously he did, one of the key things was he clearly on board with the plan, and he did, you know, this boy Ronaldo understands football apparently because he did what the new manager wants, and he's obviously going to be good at that.
It is going to be difficult, Barney, for Wilson if Rangnick is a huge success and turns Ronaldo into a pressing success. That will be difficult for him.
Yeah, and people do underrate. I've done it as well. Of course Ronaldo understands the game. And of course he can do it. But it might be really good for him. Maybe this is what he needs. Maybe he's been indulged and managers have said, okay, Cristiano, you go and do that thing where you're just basically a sniper and you have that, you just wait for the chances. Maybe he needs someone to say, he's super fit. I mean, you know, maybe he needs someone to say, how about playing this way? And it will bring something really good out of him. You know, who knows? It'll be fascinating to watch.
I'm fascinated by the fact that Barney used to manage an under-12 team. And I want to know what his management style was. Tracksuit suit, lean against the dugout, chewing gum, or were you gesticulating furiously?
Hairdryer, half time.
Very sort of, I'd say, studious, tracksuited, keep a distance, you know, keep the players guessing. Say gnomic things at half time that don't really make any sense, but yeah, not particularly successful. Ed Ahrens is a successful junior manager. He's in the tracksuit every weekend.
You weren't on the training ground most. You'd leave that to your coaches.
Yeah,
and you'd just be overseeing things. So, you were sort of liaising with the chairman about recruitment a lot of the time. Max says, "Is it possible that Fred is right-footed and he just forgot? It would explain a lot." It was a brilliant goal, Troy, wasn't it?
Great strike, absolutely great strike. From someone that looks rejuvenated since the previous manager has left, because his performance against Arsenal was up there as well, and he's engaging higher up the pitch, which obviously Ollie probably didn't trust him to do, you know, and he's proving in this short space of time how good and effective he can be. And yeah, I don't think I've ever seen him kick the ball with his right foot in all the time that I've watched him. So for him to plant the ball in the back of the net in that way was brilliant.
I thought it had to have been deflected. I kept watching it thinking that must have taken a deflection.
I was actually of the same opinion, Max. I actually thought as well that it took a nick off of somebody and obviously, you know, landed over Gaeta's head. But no, it actually went straight from foot to goal. It was an absolutely great finish.
Barry, we should mention Jordan Ayew's miss, which would have changed a lot of the narrative after the game.
I just don't understand what Jordan Ayew brings to the Crystal Palace party. He seems to be undroppable. He never scores. Some of his misses are just astonishing, and that was another one. And he should have put them a goal up, and that would have put the cat among the pigeons. But I would be interested if any sort of seasoned Palace fans could let us know what it is that Jordan Ayew is for, basically.
Spurs 3, Norwich 0. That was a lovely goal from Lucas Moura, wasn't it, Barney? He said, "I don't see myself as a killer like Sonny and Kane." I mean, not like Kane at the moment, but I like that honesty from Moura. It was just a brilliant goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's one of those players who has not been quite as good as you thought he was going to be. I mean, it's easy to forget he was, really, really highly rated when he moved to PSG. And, you know, his speed, he can dribble, everything. He just seems kind of almost a bit too nice, nice in some ways, not ruthless enough. But when he does something good, he looks really good. And you wonder if Conte, because he's able to press really, he's got so much energy from the front. And he was really instrumental when Kane was out and they reached the Champions League final. That was his really best spell at Spurs, I thought. So Conte will really like his energy and stuff. So maybe he can get the most out of him.
Three wins in a row for Spurs, Troy. But I can't work out if they're good or not yet. I don't know what you think.
Listen, he's playing with the same, but he's mixing with the same players. I don't think Conte believes that they're really good or not at the moment, if you want me to be totally honest. Norwich, had a lot of possession yesterday, didn't they? It's almost as if Spurs allowed Norwich to have that possession. And if Norwich were more clinical in one, two early situations, one in the first half, Pukki, and another in the second half, right at the beginning, we could be talking about a totally different game here. Spurs were clinical for once in the three goals that they scored. I think there must still be a worry about Harry Kane. And I think that come January, he'll be spending a lot of Daniel Levy's money, because I don't think that the team, the squad, although, you know, there'll be Spurs fans saying at the moment, well, you know, we're only a couple of points behind West Ham, and we're talking about West Ham in such good terms that why should we not be speaking about Spurs in the same terms? But, you know, I just don't believe that he thinks that that squad will be good enough to take them through the rest of the season. And he'll make some fundamental changes come January. And I think one of those changes will be in his midfield, because I think he needs a lot more creativity in that environment. I must applaud someone like Ben Davis, who very much like Fred, looks like a player reborn, and all of a sudden is in the attacking box and, you know, creating opportunities for players. So there's been some good parts of what they're doing, and they're winning games. And I think sometimes you just got to get over the line until January and then make the changes that the new manager wants.
If you think about it, there's nothing missing there now. They've got this. They've got the best stadium, you know, in Europe. It's incredible. One of the best, anyway. They've got a very, very good manager who's incredibly ambitious and arrogant and vain and won't hang around if the team isn't very good. He obviously thinks the squad is hopeless and can't believe what he's seen in the dressing. Some of his comments were like, oh, I didn't realise it's like that. And he won't bother working with those players who clearly aren't going to give everything. He'll just go somewhere else because he sees himself as a man of destiny who should be winning things. But all they need to do is turn on the money tap, and they've got an incredible setup there. They're selling out their stadium. It's okay. You know, COVID seems to have gone a bit. They can fill it. They can have American football, whatever it is they want to do in there. They've got Conte. And people forget how rich Joe Lewis is. I mean, he is very, very rich. He's very, very old. You can't take it with you. You know, this would be the moment that they've relaxed financial fair. No one cares about that anymore. You know, they're letting you spend whatever you want. All you need to do is drop masses of money into that project, and Spurs will do really well. It's the ultimate test of whether they can be bothered to actually win, because what they do in that window will make a massive difference, and they can do it.
Let's go to Elland Road, Leeds 2, Brentford 2. Barry, this was a good game, wasn't it?
Very entertaining. I would imagine both managers will feel they probably should have won. I felt for Leeds a bit because they finally get to bring Luke Ayling and Patrick Bamford back, only to lose Liam Cooper and Calvin Phillips, who both went off injured. So Cooper will be missing for whatever it is, 4 to 6 weeks with a hammy. I don't know how bad the injury to Phillips is, but it was entertaining and the draw was probably a fair result. And good to see Patrick Bamford back on the score sheet. He said himself after the game that he was pretty rusty. I think he played 90 minutes of an under 21 game last Monday, and but said he was very rusty, and if he hadn't scored the goal, his performance would have been completely pointless, basically.
The most fun part of this game was the Leeds director of football, Victor Orta, who I've not spent a lot of time watching, but I now plan to spend a lot of time watching. Absolutely livid at full time, you know, in a kind of he's not worth it, Darren type, pointing and yelling at someone and being sort of pushed away by various other members of the sort of Leeds hierarchy. That was tremendous.
He does have quite a lot of previous in the field of losing the plot and doing bonkers things.
He has got history, without doubt.
Oh, good. One to watch. Aston Villa 2, Leicester 1. Another intense, breathless game this, Troy, wasn't it?
Breathless, yes. Moment of controversy probably is the biggest thing to highlight here, isn't it?
And yeah, let's
again,
talk about it.
Something happens and you think to yourself, has the rule changed? And if it changed, when did it change? Because we were not aware. I didn't know that a goalkeeper could have one hand on the ball. And as long as it's, if I've got this right, by the way, and as long as it's touching any kind of surface, he is then in control of the ball, or they are then in control of the ball. So when Ramsey put it home, I'm going, great finish. Great finish. Well done. You know, great anticipation. He's not got both hands on the ball. Bam, goal. So then to go to VAR and there to be all this confusion and then the decision to go to Leicester City, I was sitting there confused, but I'm well aware that you're not allowed to really have a go at officials anymore, are you? Because it's then deemed that you don't know what you're talking about rather than they don't know what they're doing. So I'm still a bit unclear because I watched Match of the Day last night and they put the ruling up and there was this thing about no commas and semicolons in the way that the ruling was put out. So I'm still of the opinion that that should have stood. I don't know what Barney thinks or Barry thinks, but I think that should have stood because I don't think that Schmeichel was in control with his hand on the ball loosely, and I think they were nails, they wasn't his hand, was in control of that football. And if we're chalking goals out for that, then, well, you know.
We might as well all go home. We might as well all just pack up and go home. Well, Barney, what do you think?
Well, I think I agree with Troy in that goalkeepers goalkeepers are really overprotected. I don't know if that's what you were saying, actually. But you can basically kick someone in the head if you're a goalkeeper. And then if you're sort of leaned on, it's a foul. But in that situation, he did kick his hand. I mean, he hurt his hand. His hand really hurt. It was kicked while it was on the ball. And if you kicked someone...
Was his hand really hurting, Barney? Or did he use that for the maximum impact?
I don't know.
He may have been faking, the goal was not given.
He did kick his hand. And if you kick someone's shin, you'd probably say that's a free kick. Now, if you kick a bit of someone's body, it's generally a free kick. Or there's a case for it to be a free kick. So I think that's essentially some logic there. If you think people fall over just because somebody leans on them or puts a hand on their shoulder, a part of his body was kicked, which so often seems to be a free kick. So I guess there's consistency in that respect. But I mean, I agree. Did he have control of the ball? No, he'd say two hands is control of the ball. He failed to get two hands on it. And just touching it doesn't mean it's yours and everyone else has to stop.
Well, I'm with you that I always thought it was too, you know, like yelling around the playground going, I had two hands on it. You know, I don't know when that law changed. I like Troy that you say if he's got one hand on the ball and the ball's on any other surface. So you're talking pitch, the woodwork,
Max,
what,
that's not
side,
my, that's
sideboards, glass tables. Like, what other surfaces is he going to have?
Apparently. That's apparently what it says, something like that. Maybe we need to get the ruling up. Because
what about the chest of a teammate?
Hand...
What if he's got the ball and Soyuncu, whose chest is there, and then he's got the ball?
I can read it if it's quite boring, but if you want...
Please, Can we? Have we got time?
Sure. A goalkeeper is considered to be in control of the ball with the hands when the ball is between the hands or between the hand and any surface, for example, ground, own body, or by touching it with any part of the hand or arms, except if the ball rebounds from the goalkeeper or the goalkeeper has made a save. So that except kind of cancels out everything that went before it.
Yeah, because he'd made a save and then he put his hand on
it. So going by that logic, the goal should have stood. But I don't know.
That, right. And then for the Premier League and PGMOL to not give out a statement that clarifies it, although I'm not sure you can clarify that any more than the clarity that we have, Anyway.
St James's Park, then. Newcastle beating Burnley 1-0. First win, first clean sheet, level on points with Norwich and Burnley. A reasonably tricky December they've got. Liverpool, Manchester United, Leicester, Manchester City. And I suppose then they play Everton, so that's their easy game. What did you make of this, Barry? You enjoyed how much the Newcastle fans enjoyed this victory.
Yeah, look, I totally get that they were delighted to win a game, but the celebrations of a 1-0 home win over Burnley were slightly over the top, to say the least. I can only imagine if that's how much they celebrate a scratchy win at home against Burnley, God knows how much or how crazy they'll go when they win the Premier League and Champions League in 6 or 7 years' time. There was an interesting photo after the game. They did the dressing room celebration photo. I think I counted nearly 40 players and backroom staff in the photo. And I'd quite like to print that off, and it'll be like Marty McFly's photo of his family on Back to the Future, you know, as various players fade out of it because they're no longer at the club and have been replaced, and various backroom staff. But they won a game. They're happy. A little bit done, a hell of a lot more to do. I think they may well stay up, but we'll see.
Now let's go to St Mary's. Southampton 1, Brighton 1. Neil Mopai doing it again. 89th minute in the previous game against West Ham. 98th minute here. First touch was great to control that in the finish. Afterwards, he said, there's a phrase in French, déjà vu, which you may have heard of, which almost reminds me of, I don't know if anyone's seen, it's not particularly football related, Alexandra Burke, who's released a song called Elephant in the Room. And she said she heard the phrase in America and she thought she should be the one to bring that phrase over to the UK. So it's very good of Alexandra
Burke. Is anyone going to mention the elephant in the room there?
I don't know. It does remind me of the week that Keys and Gray were sacked by Sky. I said that we should have a full-sized elephant in the studio and just never mention it. But that idea was no one ran with it. It's a great shame. Anyway, Everton Arsenal tonight. Troy, does Andros want Rafa out? There? Is Andros want Rafa out? Did he want Marcel Brands out? What can you tell us?
You are not asking me that question. Surely you're not. Something definitely was going to give, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, Marcel Brands has gone. Joined in 2018. £300 million has been spent since then. Fans attending tonight's game have been encouraged to take part in a protest organised by various fan groups entitled 27 Minutes for 27 Years, representing the number of years Everton have gone without a trophy come the end of the season. The plan being for supporters to walk out of the ground in the 27th minute as a show of their displeasure under the governance and management of the club under Farhad Moshiri, which means many of them will see more.
What are they protesting against?
Well, they haven't won a trophy in 27 years. They're working out the 27th minute.
Against? Well, who's the protest against? Because they spent loads of money and they've had lots of really good managers in. So are they protesting against about 140 people in that period who've been involved in the management or seen? I mean, what do they want someone to do? Give them a trophy? That's really strange. Like, how much more money?
I think it's definitely split opinion. It's definitely a split opinion, Barney. I've seen on social that some of the fans are saying this is crazy. You know, exactly what you've said, by the way. You know, what are we expecting? We've had money. You know, we've got a group of players in, and now they're talking about the fact that the squad is so thin this season with a few injuries that they've had, that the squad should be performing better. And it's exactly what you said. No team has a divine right, do they? You know, no club has a divine right to win and win trophies. And there'll be lots of teams that haven't won for a period of time. So maybe we will start seeing mass walkouts at a number of grounds over the next few seasons.
I mean, to be fair, quite a lot of Everton fans didn't see 27 minutes of the Merseyside derby. So they'll see more of this game, regardless of what happens. Anyway, good luck to Everton and Arsenal in equal measure. That'll do for part two. Susie Rack joins us to talk about the FA Cup final from last season where Chelsea hammered Arsenal in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's welcome the Guardian's women's football correspondent, Susie Rack. Hey, Susie.
Hey, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, very good. So at Wembley yesterday, Chelsea hammered Arsenal 3-0. Before we talk about, you know, the significance of the day and all it meant, can we just talk about that Sam Kerr chip? Because it was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it?
It was cheeky. It was really, really nice. She's just such a phenomenal player. Like, I think what got a bit lost yesterday was the fact that she had flown to Australia, played two games against the US, the world champions, got a stomach bug, so actually not played the full extent of the second game, flown back to UK on Thursday, trained once before the cup final and then scores twice in the cup final and then, like, obviously the second in quite beautiful style. I mean, it's really quite unbelievable that she was even able to, like, get on the pitch and start the game, let alone do what she did in it.
I mean, I did fly in once from Australia and land on Saturday morning, do a radio show and then score the winner against Hampstead Heathens in the Southern Amateur League Intermediate Division 4. So, you know, I think pretty straightforward, frankly. I mean, Chelsea was so good, Susie, in this game, weren't they? And Arsenal, I mean, it felt like, you know, when Barcelona hammered Chelsea, like the first 10 minutes it was done, it felt in that like that in this game, that Chelsea were just all over them from right from the start.
Yeah, and in the same way as in that final, Arsenal were a little bit unlucky with that first goal in that, you know, Lotta went to clear it and it ricocheted off of, who was it? It was Frieda Manham into the run of Fran Kirby, which, were, you know, obviously is particularly unfortunate. But from there on, they, like, very much were entirely riding their luck. So, I mean, it was a sign of things to come. I mean, Arsenal had problems in that they didn't have Lea Williamson at centre back because she's out injured with a hamstring injury, and that is a massive blow. But I mean, it's hard to pick out one poor player because they were all awful. And yeah, Chelsea were absolutely rampant. I think the nicest thing was that they were just so quick in their passing. It was 1-2 touch football, which was kind of ironic in that, like, on Friday, Arsenal had an open training and you could hear Jonas, the manager, like, yelling at them to play faster, fewer touches, etc. And they just, yeah, when they came up against a team that actually did that, they just couldn't cope.
Susie, after the game, Jonas had the players in form a circle and had a very long sort of talking, gave them a very long talk. I wouldn't say dressing down. I don't know. Do you have any idea what was being said there?
No, I mean, he said after the final whistle, he felt very powerless at the lost opportunity and that called it a lost opportunity. And he said, like, in his post-match, he said that he's not a person driven by hatred or motivated by seeing other people celebrate and things like that, but that he would like his players to be standing in the position as winners and said they deserve it. And it's easy to forget how soon they are into the journey with him as a manager. Like, they got him in the summer. He's made very few signings of his own. They are playing a different way. They are pressing much, much more than they were under Joe Montemurro. And, like, things don't change overnight. The defensive problems that Arsenal have always had, and like I'd say the mental problem that they've always had, in a way they're their own worst enemies. They do seem to like fold under pressure against top sides. And I don't know if you saw it on the TV and stuff, but Idaval was at one stage holding up signs which had blue, like blue on one side and red on the other. No idea what they meant. No one asked him in the post-match, unfortunately. But like, nothing changed when he held up those signs. There was no discernible difference on the pitch. You just thought, what is he doing? Like, talk to your players. Like, it was just bizarre. And I know that when they trained at the Emirates on Friday, like, he talked about wanting to train there to use a sound system because it was going to be noisy at Wembley and, you know, communicating is harder when you've been used to not having fans in. But the signs were very, very strange.
I felt that he got slightly alpha'd by Emma Hayes. I saw them talking before kickoff, and in a way managers don't normally talk, and it all seemed really, really nice, and he was sort of, oh right, okay, thanks. And then Chelsea just absolutely tore into them. His team and him just didn't seem to have the same level of aggression at all. I thought that, and towards the end, I love watching Emma Hayes celebrate like a totally different person to the kind of, oh, hi, yeah, yeah, it's great to be here, isn't it, great occasion. And then they were just utterly ruthless, and I thought, you've just been completely done. But it was a really good...
That was deliberate,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I thought it was really clever, and she bossed him completely.
Yeah, he celebrated, like, absolutely wildly in that first game of the season against Chelsea, like, on his knees, like, fist-pumping, like, screaming his face off. So, like, yeah, to beat him in the cup final. And then in the press conference, she was absolutely hilarious. I mean, he had told us about his cat suit, his black cat superstition in the presser on Friday, and then she was literally purring throughout the presser and making cat and purring references. And then one of the players, who hilariously is one of his former players from Rosengard, a Swedish goalkeeper, was put up a picture on Facebook of the trophy covered in black cats. And then Arsenal had done this little ad, like little video with where they had some of the players in like red overalls and a white van painted red, saying "Let's paint London red," and had them, you know, paint cans and that kind of stuff. And honestly, she must have dropped that "We've painted London blue" in about 30 dozen times, and all the players did as well. Like, they clearly were really riled up by this like talk from Arsenal ahead of the game. It really had an effect.
Chip says, should the FA glue the trophy lid? Or is that health and safety gone mad? As Millie Bright, the thing just landed, like, did it cut her eye or something? Like, it was like looked quite sore. Everyone's cheering, and she's sort of down, holding her forehead. I thought it was very funny. She all right? She okay?
I don't know. No one asked. We only saw that video like hours after the game, but I mean, it's kind of hilarious. I mean, she's an absolute like machine, so I doubt anything would touch her. Sure. But yeah, like, pretty hilarious. Not the first one funny to have mishaps with the cup.
No. Now look, Chelsea won the treble last year, then this is last year's FA Cup. Do expectations change? Is it all about the Champions League for them? Because, you know, they have the infamous unfinished business in that competition, don't they?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think so. Like, Emma's won everything there is to win domestically. Done the, well, she kept, it's a domestic treble, she kept calling it the quadruple because they won the Community Shield, but no one could ever count that. And yeah, like, it's all the Champions League. I mean, the only team that has like humbled them in the way that they did to Arsenal is Barcelona. And they're just so, so far above. And we'll see that. I mean, they're likely going to absolutely smash Arsenal on Thursday night at the Emirates. It's going to be a pretty horrific week for Arsenal in the grand scheme of things. So yeah, I think like it has to be Champions League. That's exactly what everything Emma is doing is like set up for. You know, every player that she signs is about adding the depth and quality to be able to compete in the Champions League, and working this team towards being a point where they have the connections and like intuitiveness of those Barcelona players, which has been built over like 5 or 6 years.
41,000 people were there. It was on the 50th anniversary of the competition. Heard a really interesting interview with, is it Leslie Lloyd, the Southampton captain from 71, who said, you know, they sort of had tea and cake before the game and they were too muddy afterwards. And so
they arranged to have the photos done the week later so they didn't look so muddy. And it was 100 years since women's football was banned in this country. Do you think it was like a good idea to put it on this day and make a real point of that date?
Yeah, it was a good occasion. Like they had all of the, I say all of, most of the captains that have lifted the FA Cup come out at halftime. Two of them brought the cup out at the start, and it was quite a nice nod because you're talking about players that were, if anything, like a lot is made of the players that played before the ban, you know, Ditka ladies and those kind of teams. But if anything, the harder job was the ones that are playing while football was banned, and were doing it like in direct defiance of the FA and FIFA and UEFA, and, you know, having to sort of travel around the world at very early ages just to be able to compete at any kind of sort of semi-professional level. So like, it's nice to have a nod to them because they just do not get looked at all, really, or remembered at all. And it's like been nice that putting the cup final on this day at least gave the opportunity for some of those stories to be told a little bit more widely.
Cool. Susie, thanks for coming on.
No problem. Cheers for having me.
Susie Rack, the Guardian women's football correspondent. In the FA Cup second round, all the games happened. You know why. There weren't any major, major upsets, but Harrogate did well to beat Portsmouth at Fratton Park. Well done to them. Ipswich have sacked Paul Cook. Richard Jolly, big chance for Ipswich to hire a fourth consecutive manager called Paul now, which we very much hope they do. Ryan says, please bring some much-deserved attention to this celebration against Paul Scholes Salford on live TV on your next pod. Yeah, I think the last time you were on, Barney, we discussed the toe-sucking antics of Paul Scholes, and the Chesterfield players recreated it with a celebration, which was nice to see as Chesterfield beat Salford 2-0. Onto your emails, we don't have a lot of time left, so let me just read one of them from Emil, who says... Dear Max, Barry and co, I believe I've broken the record for the most minutes of Football Weekly listened to on Spotify this year with 10,986. See this screenshot below. I started listening to the pod around 2015. I was born in the year 2000. I took a couple of years off after listening to the infamous Witch's Curse episode due to how much it frustrated me. I thought it was one of my favourites, but there we are. Time heals all wounds, though. And a few years ago, I once again became a devoted listener. I was astounded by listener Cara's quest to listen to every Football Weekly episode. What a tremendous idea. When a new pod comes out, I typically listen to it 2 to 3 times a day on repeat until you release the next one. Look at your face, Barney. While this can be a lot of fun, after a few listens, I often find myself completing Barry's sentences. It occasionally makes me wonder whether I'm going crazy, trapped in an infinite loop of pod deja vus. Now, thanks to Cara, I have an entire trove of fresh podcasts to listen to. Thanks, Cara. And of course, thank you all for your wonderful podcast. It's quite extraordinary. Is it like, producer Joel said this, is it like a great comedy that, you know, you the second or the third time you listen to the pod, you really get the inner meaning of it? I mean, I think I'm a huge fan of people listening to it once. Any more than that, I feel, is perhaps overkill.
Yeah, I listened to it once and that was kind of enough. I haven't listened to it since. I always think this pod... I'm just not very good at the pod. The person who I appear to be on the pod is really not who I...
Oh, really?
This is what I'm like. If you wake me up really early and force me to talk about football, and I can hear myself being irritable and interrupting people and not being very good at speaking into a... If we could record this at 7 in the evening... after we'd all had a nice dinner and we weren't, you know, we'd all done our work. I'd be a complete, people would think of me as a totally different person. I'd be really, I'd be really nice and enthusiastic. And
I'm more than happy to do the real Barney Ronne pod when we record it at a time of your choosing and we hear quite what the, you know, we just hear the all new Barney. I'll be honest, I'm always delighted when I know that you're on the pod and I think you're an integral part of it. I'm not just saying that because you're there. But if you've got more to give, I'm really excited to tap it, to unearth.
I was going to say the pressure of that, though, Barney. Oh, I'm telling you.
Well, that would be... that. Yeah, I'd have nowhere to hide then. But I've been on this about 200 times and every time I'm on, I'm just this kind of arsehole. I'm kind of irritable. I'm interrupting Barry. I'm tired. I'm rubbing my eyes. You say someone listens to the pod three times a day, and I'm thinking, what are you doing that for? But it's just.
Well, I agree with you on that.
It's so early in the morning, and I'm not very good at talking about stuff like this. Yeah, I'd like to apologise to all the listeners for this. It's not my idea. I never really wanted to do it.
I should say Noah listened to us for 19,021 minutes, according to his Spotify Unwrapped.
The guy who listened to us for 10,986 minutes on Spotify in a year, that's 7.6 24-hour days.
Hmm. Well, did you hear about the one who's listened 19,021 minutes?
So that's nearly a fortnight of 24-hour days.
Yeah. And as this one has been really long, that's going to be even longer, so we should probably end. Troy, thank you.
Absolute pleasure, Max, as always.
Barney, thank you.
Thanks, bye.
Barney, you did a really good job. Don't be down on yourself.
Oh, no, another one of these. The feelings of shame.
Barry.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you. Champions League this week, we'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.